Bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by WiredTree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Welcome to the After Things podcast. I'm Andrew Main, joined by Justin Robert Brushwood.
Aha, I psyched you out. Yeah. I tried to fake like I was going to drink because I knew you would suddenly switch to me.
That, of course, was Brian Brushwood, and the other cackling person you hear is Justin Robert Young.
Well, hello.
Gentlemen, let's jump right into an email that I didn't actually read, and I'm going to just read it for the first time so I can have a whole total Ron Burgundy moment right now. From William, I took Andrew's advice and I wrote a book. I'm almost finished with a sequel, and my question is, how much editing is considered best practice? On the first book, I paid for professional editing, and it made a big difference. I only had the budget for one round of developmental editing and one round of line editing. Is it more common to do multiple rounds? What does Andrew do for self-published work, and how does it compare to traditional publishing? Love the show. By the way, my first book is called Brains in Chains, and it's a Douglas Adams-style humorous sci-fi about artificial intelligence. Awesome. So that is the trick, is how much editing should you do? Ideally, you want to do as much editing to get – man, my slur in my speech today. You want to do as much editing to get rid of the mistakes as you can. That's not really possible, though. I've picked up major releases, million-selling books by big names, and I find mistakes. That doesn't mean that you should have mistakes, but it just tells you that will happen no matter what. I have a couple books I've yet to even send to my agent because I have not gotten around to doing an edit on them. And clearly that's a bad idea. If you don't have the means to hire an editor to do it and to do a pass, and some people do different checks than others, and there are different kinds of edits. There can be a developmental edit where somebody will say, let's fix this and this. There can be a copy editor who goes to look through there for those sort of mistakes. There can be kind of a continuity editor. But if you're looking for just basically spelling mistakes and stuff, ideally, the hard part is you could say if you can get a friend to do it, but friends are good at big notes. Friends are hard at little notes like that, I would say.
And also, having been somebody who's – friends are quick to say yes and slow to deliver the good. Like to them, a friend might be tempted to say like, oh, he wants me to read his book. I'm reading his book. And then you're like, well, what did you think? What did you notice? You're like, oh, it's great. It's great. You know, that is a challenging place to be.
My advice is this, is if let's say assuming, I don't know what resources you have, but I'll assume that you don't have anybody you can go to. I'll assume that it's up to you. I have one of my best friends here is I have a black and white laser printer. The reason I have a black and white or a monochrome laser printer is it is the cheapest way to print things out. Super cheap. Your toner and your paper is really, really inexpensive. You're buying it from Amazon. I have a book I'm working on that I'm doing a first pass on. It's my own before, and I want to do a lot of notes and stuff. I am going to do a printout of that at some point, chapter by chapter, sit down, more to do for kind of story points. But if I were to release it on my own, I would print out one chapter at a time, sit down at a table with a red pen, and I would do my edit that way. Your brain handles things differently when you have it in front of you. And if I was going to try to release it, if I was going to take, let's say, the sequel to Station Breaker, which I finished like a year ago, if I was going to try to release that book, what I would do, and if I was just going to do it my own, I would do the same thing. I'd print it, and then I would read it aloud. And the best thing you can do to self-edit is they say to read things backwards, go backwards paragraph by paragraph, but is impossible to do. It's great advice, but you can't do it. I mean, I can't do it. Maybe you can, but the second best thing I can say is print it out, read it aloud, and that's when you'll become aware of your homonym interchanges. You're going to realize where you're missing commas, where you're missing things. You have two the's, whatever. I know it's tedious.
What I like about that is that it puts you in the mind of a performer. Like this, the moment that you start reading something out loud, and I've done this for scripts that I've written down that I thought were a good idea at the time. Like when you just read your own words, you think of it as I'm reading my words and you know what you meant and stuff. But when you switch to reading it out loud, you are giving a performance. You enter a different modality. And as a result, this is just the script. And the guy who wrote it, even though it happened to be you, is some dude in the past and you current person giving a performance of this alone in your room or for a camera or on a voice recording has a totally different agenda. And you're the one who gets annoyed when a sentence is clumsily written and you're like, I don't know, how am I supposed to read this? This, you know, I'm trying to deliver this and this is clumsily written. I think that's a really great way to take, to access a different aspect of your brain and see it from a different perspective.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it also that's is very important to highlight that there is such a gigantic difference between developmental editing and line editing. You know, if you've ever come out of a movie and you're like, oh, wow, that movie could have been better if they would have done this and this. But wait, if you were going to do this and this, then that had to stay the same later in the story, or this had to be a different thing earlier in the story. That's developmental editing. Developmental editing is you are going to be among the few people in the embryonic process of this story to help shape where things go. Right. And really what I used to do when I would read Andrew's work was just from my perspective, say, OK, well, this is what in a perfect world, if I could go to the author, which I was, and say, you know, more of this, or I wasn't clear on this, or this is important. And I really like this. Is there any way that we can get to this quicker? Like, those are those questions where line editing is really just like what Andrew said, you know, the like super tedious through with a fine tooth comb, like just doing the work to find any and every little mistake that you can.
So I would say, as Brian pointed out too, that I want to really reinforce that I found even going from my desktop to an iPad and reading it to then outputting it into reading on a Kindle, you look at things differently. And part of what happens is when you change the line width from what you write into something else, that's one thing that changes. When you just have a different way to look at it, you will pick things up easier. I know I never try to edit in the same medium that I wrote it in. That's key. Don't try to edit in the same environment you wrote it, because you didn't catch it when you wrote it. So you want to shape that up. Even changing the style of font can make it different. Your eyes will pick it up. And as you read it aloud, as Brian says, it's a different part of the brain is trying to make sense of this. So that's the best process. And, you know, if you write an average length book, to read it aloud without interruptions would be about 8 hours. So if you say that, let's double that to 16 hours, if you spread that across, you know, a few hours a day, you can do 4 or 5 days. You can go through and do a really good edit of your book. So, and that's a good practice. It's certainly, I notice when I go back and I do that, like a thing that I really try to avoid in my writing is being repetitious with words. You know, not be like, he said, this person said, that person said. There's nothing wrong with that. Like Isaac Asimov would use that a lot, but I think that can be kind of tedious. I think there are certain kinds of repetitions that
Do you think part of that comes from your affinity for audiobooks like me? Because I noticed that, you know, in an audiobook, at some point, the dialogue is clearly one person and another person back and forth. And, you know, oftentimes you get readers who will do different voices. Or do you think that you just, even when you're reading it, you find it tedious?
I notice it when I read it. And I think that I think that it can create some sort of confusion. I think that I entertain like the idea that one of the things that makes us think or process that we have this, our brain at any given time is sort of doing this sort of quantum branching of sort of thing, entertaining several possibilities at once. And then once we have proof of one thing, everything else collapses and we kind of write over it and we forget how we entertain multiple things. And when you're reading, you're keeping track of a lot of different things. And if you see a word come up once and the word comes up again, it kind of triggers back and it kind of, I think it sort of interferes with the narrative flow because your brain is sort of like, wait, did I just read? Oh no, I didn't read that. Okay, I'm cool. And it's hard to really quantify that. But I strive hard, and I've gotten books back from editors who've like, if I had this multiple times where they're like, oh, why don't you use this word instead? I'm like, because I already used that word. You know, that word's there in that paragraph before and I need a different word. And maybe this doesn't fit as best, but it reads better. You know, how things read is an important thing. You can have the information
pretty important
there,
for a book.
Yeah.
I mean that more than just sort of like, is it readable? But the idea is does it flow? You get in this hung up like a bad poem. You know, like I gotta write poetry, but if you write poetry and you have it a slightly off where the rhyming word comes through, you're like, okay, it's a little jarring.
I just keep adding the word excitedly to every line in the book. That way it's more exciting. You know?
Well, yeah, there are words. Because
otherwise, if you don't
say
it, they won't know how excited people are.
Well, but you know, the funny thing is, so I'm writing a middle grade book right now, and I'll have to do another pass too, because I know that some of the stuff I'm writing sounds like adult, and I'll have to go do another pass on that and try to get over that, because, you know, and try to get, and like, sometimes that's okay. Cause in middle grade, suddenlies and things like that, kids are more tuned to sort of, you tell them we're excited, like, yeah, I'm excited. And we're an adult. It's like, why am I excited? And a kid, you have to have a balance of that.
Yeah. But, you know, yeah. What? This might be a branching point, but, you had mentioned that you've been doing a lot of Periscopes lately, and I tuned in for a bit of one of them. And in fact, I went to comment or give a heart or something, and it told me to log in, and I was like, eh, I got something else to do.
Andy's not worth a heart.
But you were talking about writing for young adult fiction and about how oftentimes publishers don't or think something is too high a concept for a young adult. And your advice, if I remembered it correctly, was like the way you write for young adults is to write a good story and then just, you know, make it told in such a way that it's appropriate for that age. Like start, don't try to dumb anything down. It seemed to be your advice.
Yeah. I mean, you certainly have to think about in your audience, like there are going to be fewer subplots. There are going to be fewer things. Things have to be more obvious. Things have to be out there on the surface more. And I'm going through that there, but I still try to write. I want, I want it to be interesting enough for an adult to read it and not feel like they're talked down to. And I have a problem because some people said, oh, have you read this? I'm like, yeah, I read that when I was 7 and I wouldn't have touched it when I was 10. And right. And I liked the books that if you read it when you're 7, you'll like it when you're 10, you'll like it when you're 12. You know, the Harry Potter books evolved.
The like Wrinkle in Time kind of stuff where it's like you could go back and appreciate it on different levels.
Yeah. I mean, you look at a book like The Hobbit. You know, that's a book that like 9-year-olds can read.
Or Watership Down. I remember Penny read Watership Down at age 8 and just got to the end. Like I read the last few pages with her. Just side by side reading silently at the same time. And meanwhile, I'm just bawling at the last few pages. And then Penny's like, oh, that was good. And it's like, well, hey, did you recognize what happened at the end? He's like, yeah, the bunny went to the place where, you know, all the bunnies are happy. It's like, okay, that's well, accurate.
But I would say like, but even like digging into like Hobbit for a second, if I went to a publisher and said, you know, I want to write a story that's based on Scandinavian and old German folklore that's going to pull upon these themes of these archetypes and stuff and kind of deal sort of the ideas of my own personal fear of mechanization, industrialization, because, you know, I'm a affluent, you know, English person who has no idea how the rest of the world works, you know, whatever. You know, they'd be like, oh, that's a great premise. You wanted kids? This is going to be for kids? And yeah. It's a great. I mean, but it would be hard to get that book published. And I brought up that Harry Potter got turned down 40 times. 40 people said no to the greatest children's literary and film franchise in history. They said, no, I don't see much potential here.
I wonder how much of that was the curse of knowledge. Like everybody who was in a position to either thumbs up or thumbs down it had read a lot of fantasy before. And my big gripe with Harry Potter is that it feels like such entry level fantasy because it is, but as a result to somebody who has experienced Lord of the Rings or whatever, it's just like, yeah, no, you know, whatever, a hippogriff, oh, you know, but to somebody who's never experienced all that idea or the simple idea of a sorting hat should be treated like it's the biggest deal in the world.
I think that was part of, cause like, I describe the first Harry Potter book as the first 30 pages is Roald Dahl, and then it gets into Terry Pratchett for kids. But I don't mean that derisively. I think that Rowling was trying to find her voice, and it first feels like Roald Dahl, but then once it's this Pratchett, and that's why people who read a lot of Terry Pratchett, it felt familiar, but I'm like, yeah, but it's kids and it's a friendlier version of that. You know, the Terry Pratchett world, Discworld is cool, but it's kind of scary. And it's kind of nonsensical to be nonsensical, whatever. And the Potter version of that was, as J.K. Rowling evolved that world, it got further away from just that pure whimsy, things are funny because they're funny, to rules. And we went from a book that the first book was sort of classic middle grade where nothing bad happens to somebody while they're in the scene, you know. Anybody who dies outside the chapter, to, you know, the third, fourth book where people are getting, you know, cursed in the middle of a thing with wands and vaporizing and dying in front of you, which is kind of awesome.
Yeah, I mean, that series just does such a great job of also, like, protecting its villain and just kind of unraveling the Voldemort of it all, you know, slowly, which is ultimately, I think, why, you know, as you get to the end, you almost want to like or want to be around Voldemort a little bit more than you do, just because all the previous books do such a great job of just letting that, like, you know that there's this creeping evil there, but, like, you know, kind of like Game of Thrones. It's like, you know that there is this persistent threat beyond the wall that is at some point going to be the reason why all of our heroes need to get together and we're going to have loyalties tested. But it's like in the Harry Potter world, you know, it's just very slowly, very, you know, like, oh, okay, well, now this person's here's a sympathizer. Oh, let's figure that out. Right. And now, like, oh, okay, well, now there's remnants of the old magic. And then, you know, at the point that Voldemort kind of comes back to life, you're like, oh, my God, this is insane. This is the craziest stuff ever.
Ralph Fiennes, sign me up. I'm a fan.
Totally.
He's great. So back to the like, just early talking about, like, yeah, writing is, it's trying to figure out what level you're at. And I've had, you know, back and forth with somebody trying to write something that, for another project that was middle grade, and I realized they wanted lower middle grade and actually elementary school, which is like, and that's, there's a big difference. And I've been spending a lot of time reading these books and trying to understand what makes something successful. And part of the problem you have is that the biggest successes are the outliers. And, you know, as Brian articulated, the people who read Harry Potter didn't understand that maybe this combination, why average people would go nuts for it. Because there was just, and that was with Star Wars too, is people said, we've seen this before. Star Wars borrowed a lot from Flash Gordon, a lot from Dune, but that thing we saw on screen and what happened there, just nothing ever felt like that. And that's the scary part, is you can have the most brilliant, wonderful thing in the world. The industry will probably not know that. And the hard part is you're, on one hand, we live in a world now where, as an author who writes for grownups, it's very easy to get your stuff out there. But if you want to write to middle grade, it doesn't work the same way. Self-publishing, you know, the number of self-published middle grade successes is, you know, probably non-zero, but effectively feels like zero, because that's a world that's filled with gatekeepers, librarians, teachers, and parents. They're the ones that select what books their kids are going to find about and read. And you have to go through very conventional means, publishers, et cetera, to do that. So that's kind of like, for me, my big goal 2017 is to try to get into middle grade.
Right.
Dare to dream.
I think you will.
Yeah. If you guys ever have questions, talk to the audience there for us to answer on after things. We are happy to throw our suggestions out there and give you our input and give you some of our thought on that. We had a question for Weird Things, but it's actually, I think, a pretty good after things question. This was the first one. Could you guys dig into what you think about Alpha? Have you seen projectalpha.com?
Which, by the way, to the three people on this program, means a very different thing. When I first read, yep, Project Alpha, I'm sure all three of us thought about late 1970s project that patron saint of skepticism, James Randi, put together with Banachek. I always forget the other guy's name. What was his name? Apparently you guys too. Okay, good. I don't feel bad. But basically they fooled scientists into making them think they had supernatural powers. And on the eve of publication, they revealed that, no, these are magic tricks. These are how they work.
But that's not this Project Alpha.
No, correct.
So this Project Alpha, I don't know if you guys might be more familiar with it than I am.
I'm not. I just briefly scrolled through it. But if you go to projectalpha.com, this appears to be an alternative to financing creative endeavors. For example, you know, we've talked about Patreon. We you know, the whole conceit of After Things is that we pull back the kimono a little bit and show you what it's like to be an independent creator. And in this case, you know, for us, Patreon is a great fit because it's something that the transparency of Patreon is attractive when people find out that you know, Weird Things nets us, you know, less than $500 an episode right now, or grosses less than $500 an episode. Oftentimes they're like, oh, but I really like that show. I want to support it. But if you're a bigger institution, for example, I've spoken to some podcasters that are fairly big, and I was singing the praises of Patreon, and they're like, I can't do that. I can't people can't know how much money we're making. If they do, it will be a turnoff for them. And then he disclosed the amount of money they were making. And I said, you know what? You're right. You should probably just keep that on the quiet. Let's do it that way. And so for something, and in this case, we're looking at the Geek and Sundry Network and the Nerdist Network. And they're basically creating their own kind of Howl.fm style project where you become a recurring member and you get early access to stuff. You get to be there virtually. Did you have a chance to really look over this, Bryce?
No, okay. But this sounds a lot like this reminds me a lot of Max Fun, but Max Fun doesn't have any sort of premium content, but they do donor subscriptions, and it's all their own rolled subscription service.
Well, so it says here it's $4.99 a month, and you get a 30-day free trial, I guess. Click on the thing that says, what is Alpha? So it sounds to me like this is their version of DiamondClub.tv, only you pay a monthly fee to be in the chat room and have your presence seen and felt directly live on the show, which I think they could do given the numbers that they're pulling.
Yeah. The question is that where the people who watch them want to watch them? And I think that you will certainly be able to monetize the portion of it. To be fair, in looking at it, it kind of, the thing that immediately jumps out to me is that, well, I bet you Lionsgate wants to make sure that they continue to get return on the investment for buying both those companies. On the other side, it's very curious. I mean, listen, there's you cannot swing a dead cat without hitting somebody trying to do some little mini content network now, and be they large like Netflix or small like CISO or another way that you can try to get money from a huge dialed in audience like Nerdist and Geek and Sundry both have. We'll see. I know that it's very, very, very exciting to look at the numbers that you get live streaming on Twitch or get on YouTube and say, man, it would be really, really rad to not cut anybody else in for that money, and be it ad revenue or subscription revenue in Twitch's case. So
it's Legendary, not Lionsgate, but yeah.
Oh, sorry. Legendary. Yeah. Sorry. Yeah. My mistake.
I think that what they're, the pro is $5 a month, not a lot to ask at all, you know, and particularly, you know, considering the paltry sum we ask for support of our show, but it's not a lot to ask. So it's not a really, really high point if you're into those shows and you like it. I think that's the key. The problem with networks can be that networks are a great way to say, if you like this, check out this. And that's one of the things that's worked out great for Diamond Club, is there's been a huge overlap. And that overlap is, you know, we, Justin and I were talking about this the other day, of if you, you know, following the kind of river that started out of like tech TV, you know, yeah, to my books, you know, like in the connections from tech TV to Leo Laporte to Twit to you guys, to Brian, then to you guys, then to Weird Things and my books and stuff, and how that river kind of is a bad metaphor, but y'all understand what I'm saying.
Yeah, sure. I mean, these strange, it's a windy, twisty road, but there is a continuous narrative thread for most people to get to this moment.
Yeah, of how like, hey, I like this thing here and I found this thing there. And so there's that advantage. The difficulty thing can be is that you get in this problem where people are like $5 and you look at these other shows like, man, I don't want this show. I just want my show. I'm like, well, $5 is not much to ask at all. I think that I don't know how you
that's
can tell
actually,
like they're
I'm sorry to interrupt, but that's a really good point, because if like our proposition is you like Weird Things, give us $5 a month and we'll always do Weird Things. You'll always get Weird Things and you'll get a little benefit. But if we're like $5, what a value. You get Weird Things and 72 other shows that you don't give a rat's ass about. Now all of a sudden you view it as a different thing. It's like, well, I mean, out of all these shows, I only like Weird Things. I mean, am I going to pay $5 for all this garbage that I don't care about and the one show I like? It sort of short circuits the value proposition.
Yeah, I think that, and that it does get into a problem too with the as you mentioned before, is like some things not wanting people to know how much money you're making because you're afraid your fans will not support you. I don't think I'd be very comfortable. I mean, then again, I'm not I don't tell everybody every figure on what I get for certain things, but when I'm going to crowdsource stuff or whatever like that, I like that disclosure. And I also think that should sort of put upon you the goal of returning value. And I'll give you a great example. I think that for some of the things like Scott does with Nerdtacular and all that, is that I'm not just paying a guy to do a show out of his house. I'm paying part of this thing that then gets put into, you know, this con, which of course I have to go pay to go to, but you're like, it's not just that. And you feel bad when I'm like, wait, I could do this. I could sit on my couch and do that. Why is this idiot getting paid so much money? And you really want to be thinking hard about how do I return value? How do I increase value on that? And, you know, but, you know, $5 a month, I don't think that's a bad thing to do. And I do think that that's, you know, it's going to be, it'll be interesting to see, because like, I look at that content, I'm like, there's nothing there for me, but, and I can't evaluate that, but I can certainly say that, man, if I liked one of those shows, that's good. But is it easier to do the ask like we do? Like, if you just love this.
Well, you know, and Geek and Sundry has a very, very successful Twitch channel. And I assume that part of this is giving a, you know, giving super hardcore fans the opportunity to pay them another $5 a month. And I think that that's super cool. I think the question, though, is that at some point, are you, by moving your suggested location to watch the show, are you jeopardizing your relationship with your audience in some way? Because sometimes, like, understanding where people want to view your show the most can be a huge step forward. Brian, when you went from looking at Scam School as a podcast to a YouTube channel,
right,
it opened everything up, right? Right.
Well, and also understand, and that's a case where we're changing the focus of where your presence is most felt. You know, because when we first launched Scam School, there was no, or I guess, Twitter was in its infancy, and so, and distribution, nobody was using YouTube. So we would distribute on RSS video podcast, and then we would congregate in the Revision 3 forums. And so I would respond to all the, you know, there was a place where it's like, here's the latest episode, discuss. Well, I like this. Well, why didn't you do it this way? And I could be there to interact or whatever. And after several years, it became clear that, you know, YouTube was a great collection of both the video and the comments in there. And so that was where I turned my focus. And instead, I would tweet out some stuff, and you know, eventually those forums kind of dissolved. But now we also saw the reverse of that, in that, you know, we had, when we were on Twit, a big built-in audience of people who liked the Twit Clubhouse. There was always 800 people in the chat room and all that stuff. And so when we made our departure and went independent, that was it. We're thrilled with the hundreds and thousands of people who have followed us over, but it is a fraction of the people that we had the opportunity to court. And as a result, for example, on now that Modern Rogue is building steam, it's fascinating to see how many of the comments are, oh man, that's the guy from Scam School. Whatever happened to Scam School? And the answer is, of course, nothing happened to it. You know, you stopped watching and just decided that it didn't exist anymore. So in that regard, anytime you make a big move, especially when you have a strong position, if they're, you mentioned they had a powerful Twitch channel, it does make sense to stay put and stay where the people are. But also, this is their opportunity to get those email addresses, to make people commit, the smallest commitment, to pivot from being somebody who watches in this one clubhouse to self-identifying, no, I am a member of this tribe, to where even if they only go a few months and then decide it's not worth $5, they've identified as a member of that tribe, and there's a way for them to reach out next time there's another big project.
I've been thinking about writing a book, like kind of like I did my How to Make Money on Mars, of like what your job will be when the robots take over, right? Yeah. So I had that came up on a Periscope I did the other day. I was like, what happens when the robots take over? And I referenced Matt Ridley's article about how 95% of people were, you know, in agriculture and were not bemoaning the loss of that and the fact that we don't have to put our children into fields to plow. And you look at what's happening now as we're trying to figure out, like, all this comes down to is like, hey, we like this content. How do you make this content pay for itself? But also, is there that fatigue where people are like $5 here, $10 here, $20 here a month? And you start adding all of that up. And there are certain models that seem attractive initially, like Spotify and stuff. But when you really dig into the numbers of that, there's questions of scalability, like that cannot support the music industry. And the argument can be made, well, maybe it has to change. Maybe it had a wonderful period of time when you could get paid to be a full-time musician, sort of, not really, but sort of, and that's over, and that's where things go to. Or, you know, it's like, well, as we shift from paying for one thing, then we have to sort of look at this other. And part of the problem you have is, you know, Peter Thiel's book, Zero to One, highly, highly recommend. Did you guys read that book, by the way?
I have not, but now I'm loading up Audible.
He makes a very, very, very good point in this book, and other people have made this before. We've talked about this, and Brian, it's a point you brought up, is he makes a point like you don't want to open up a restaurant. You don't want to open up a restaurant because in the restaurant industry, there is anybody can open a restaurant. It has infinite competition, and you will not get successful with a restaurant. You want to have the category definer. You want to be the killer in one area, Google, et cetera, and all that. Now, and so you get into this situation where – you know, you look through and the problem you're dealing with is like, if you don't like our show, and it turns out most people don't care about our show, there are other things you can do with your time. And when you're in entertainment, there is you have to figure out how to make a thing so compelling. Like every now and then you get category defining kind of things. And I would say Serial was that for a while. Yes, it was a form of entertainment, but it was this so different from everything else. It's not like when people are like, I want to do a show and talk about movies. Welcome to everybody else, you know?
Right.
You need to have that thing that makes you so different. And the problem you have when you do anything that's geek related, every geek in the world wants to do that and sees themselves and eventually could be potential competition. And that's going to be problematic, is figuring out, like, how do you differentiate that? And the ones that have had the success have been the ones that are building out networks. Kevin Smith's done his network. Corolla, I think, is doing that. I think that you have Nerdist, obviously, Geek and Sundry. They build these networks and sort of aggregate that because then you have a larger platform to push out from.
Earwolf and Feral Audio and, there's lots.
So that's the thing to keep in mind is like, what are, you know, how do you survive? And even then, I don't know. I'm just sort of throwing these things out there.
Let me also point out though, like as a testament of how difficult it is to get a crowd to move absent a unbeatable proposition. If I'm remembering this correctly, Bryce, I believe Vessel had $150 million of backing, and it was based entirely on the idea of let's make a better YouTube than YouTube. And so they built a superior interface. It was gorgeous. Mm-hmm. They captured all of the top YouTube clientele. They paid all of them to start saying, if you want to see the content even earlier, you can get, this is where the new Clubhouse is. It's awesome for all these reasons. They were paying these huge bounties. So there was a cash incentive for everyone to try to make it happen. It lasted just over a year before shuttering.
Over a year. I would say almost 18 months.
Yeah.
Or so.
$150 million.
Now, this was also on the back of a guy who made Hulu and you know.
Yeah.
And it got bought out. It didn't shut down. It got bought.
Right. But and folded into Verizon, right? Yeah.
Well, I think we called that, too. It's just that it's the –
Not me publicly, because I was always a happy partner of Vessel.
Mm-hmm. I'm sorry. Yes. Brian's official position has always been and always will be that Vessel's a great idea and will be perfect.
It's good. Yeah. It was ahead of its time is what it was.
Yeah, I think
three days ahead of its time.
the problem with Vessel and even the problem with YouTube Red, besides sounding a lot like Red something tube, is that, you know, there is a ton of free content out there. And the moment I get friction, you're like, the friction is go here and still pay attention. Like here's the thing, like PewDiePie has 50 million subscribers, right? It's 50 million subscribers and he's doing really well. He's making buck. But I don't think it was until last year that the number one star in all of YouTube was making on parity with what maybe the third star on NCIS or, you know, Big Bang Theory made. And people go like, well, that's not right. Like, but no, like this is a guy that has, you know, this is a guy that has the biggest social media following you could possibly imagine, yet he's doing, you know, what a second tier star on a major TV show makes. Not the number one tier, not this, not that. And so that's the problem is because the moment PewDiePie is like, well, you need to pay for my service and do this. And he will do, he's going to do great. But the moment you, he's not going to get into that alone won't get him into super huge money range, you know?
Yeah.
Because the moment there's that little bit of friction of like, well, now you have to go here to go do this. There will be people who follow him, but the drop off is huge because it's like, well, there's another guy who's pretty funny. I'll watch this too. Yeah, maybe I'll get around to that. So that's the hard part is the friction, the jump.
But that's also part and parcel. That's the upside downside of being a star in an emerging medium, right? The good news is that by virtue of being there early, being there first, and we're some of the beneficiaries of being early in the podcast market, you know, with both this program and the other shows that we do. Certainly we're beneficiaries of being one of the first places people heard about Patreon. But the downside is, you know, it is a more dominant position in a very small market to begin with. And the example I always give is the reason all of the big players, the moment cable got deregulated and anyone could have a cable station, all the big broadcasters were like, why would we bother with cable? There's nobody there. And of course, if you weren't a big player, it's like, that's why you went with cable, is because nobody was there and it was easy and cheap and you could make a 24-hour news station and you could do things that had never been done before, which is why all the big names in cable are, you know, not the same names that we have in broadcast.
True. And also, though, like we've never had, like you go back and you look at what did Magic TV specials do in the 80s, you know, the 70s, you know, Doug Henning special would get like 30 million views. Right. Mm-hmm. And that will never happen again because there are just too many other outlets now. And so that's why it's harder for one person to sort of aggregate that kind of power and do whatever now, because there's just so many other choices. You know, if you're choosing between one of three, then you're going to divide up everything by three. But if you're a choice between 100 cable channels and a million things on YouTube, you know, that is over. But yeah, somebody says you guys are using all of our Patreon dollars because you were the first. It's true. That's the thing is that, you know,
it's harder now. Like, let's say you like someone. It's not just like when we asked, hey, give us money. The question was, do I like them? Do I have the money? Yeah. But now if you've maxed out your patronage, and by the way, thank you to everyone who still keeps us on your patronage. And all of a sudden someone comes along that you also like. The question is no longer, do I like them? The question is, okay, I really like them, but do I like them enough that I will unsubscribe? I will stop donating. And if so, which of my babies do I cut off? And that's a challenging thing. And we hope we're not that baby.
Well, and that's, you know, if you're looking at how to monetize an audience, so much of what we've kind of learned with Patreon, at least for our projects, is that the support is more durable and comes freer when there's almost less promise, which I guess circles back to that whole idea of like, all right, if you're going to list 50 things and I only like one, is that better or worse of a proposition than just having the one say, hey, give us money for no reason? Like, just because you like us.
Right. I tried that one.
I was going to segue into talking more about you doing all your periscoping, but I think we pretty much covered all of that. So I got nothing.
It's fun. I love Periscope. It is. I've been enjoying it. I pop up there periodically now, do a lot. And it has been a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful way to connect with people who on Twitter who are sort of casually, I follow, they follow back and whatever, and they kind of get more into it. And I have no agenda for that right now, other than just shamelessly plugging the things I've been doing, but I've been really enjoying it. You know, it's different to sort of just hop in there, not with, hey, everybody, I'm going to do a show. I'll start with a question or whatever, but it's been extremely fun, a lot of fun. So.
Yeah. I think that's another testament to how sticky those environments are because, you know, you were saying there are people who never even knew that you wrote books and so on, which is astonishing to me that they could follow your feed and not realize that.
Yeah. I need to step up my self promotion, I guess.
but, and also you say you have no agenda, but realize that every moment of interaction you have, every moment of value, every more of your personality, that you're able to virtualize and share in the strange one-way friendship that the internet and broadcasting affords, you are building brand value. And no, it's not in a tangible this moment kind of way, but it will be felt down the road next time you saw the release. And again, I can testify for this because there's no universe in which the Monorogue launches with two unknowns, no matter how good it is like this, and it gets quite the same traction it's getting right now. I have to believe that this is a decade's worth of brand value and general goodwill that's finally, you know, being cashed in, so to speak.
And I also like, I enjoy it. The thing is the thing. And that's the thing I was thinking about, like, is that like, oh, what do you do with this thing? I'm like, I don't know. Just keep doing this fun thing while this medium is around and before it morphs into something else. That's the part of the thing I thought about is like, what's my goal? And I thought about the fact that like, I consider myself extremely fortunate that, you know, I can flip a switch and start having a conversation with a few dozen people, you know, and just, hey, I can be in the middle of my house, come back, talk to nobody all day, and be like, let's go talk to people, and boom, I'm in front of an audience and having fun and people recommending books to me or talking about things. That's value. That's the kind of thing you think about. What's my goal one day? My goal one day is to be able to flip a switch and be able to have a conversation with 30 people, you know?
Yeah.
And that's kind of cool.
Hey, what's the over under or what's your bet on the first time Trump periscopes? Like, that seems like at some point he's going to have too much to say that 140 characters won't cover it. And he's going to see that button and realize that he can
instantly. They're doing the videos. I don't know. I mean, it would make sense. You know, I mean, I think that even beyond, you know, obviously the president-elect has a very specific relationship with the Twitter platform. But, you know, it wouldn't be shocking if Obama periscoped on his last day of office, right? Like, I think that we're kind of.
Can you imagine, like,
follow me on my new Twitter channel, everybody?
Man, picks. Do you guys want to do picks?
Yes.
I got a pick. I don't know if you guys watch a lot of YouTube, but there's been a lot of hand wringing and name calling about what YouTube's doing with their algorithm. There are big celebrities saying that they're screwing things up. Yesterday, I believe, Game Theory posted a video. The Game Theory channel, which is very, very even-handed. Keep in mind,
Game Theorists.
The Game Theorists. Is YouTube killing PewDiePie and H3H3? In a world filled with everybody just making up what they think is happening and howling, rightfully terrified because, you know, these are their livelihoods and they're afraid that that with a click of a button mouse, all of a sudden YouTube can change all the rules.
What the hell?
This guy, MatPat, you know, his job is to consult for brands and channels and to explain what the best practices are and why. And his latest Game Theory episode deals with hard numbers, both from his channel and his client's channel, and gives good justifications that will help you out tremendously.
Well, what is he? Are they?
No. He talks about how for a long time that over the last year, watch the video. Basically, over the last year, they made it clear that YouTube is valuing engagement time, watch time more than individual views, which is why you've seen videos get a little bit longer. Because if you watch all of a 3-minute video, you still only watch 3 minutes. Whereas if you watch half of a 40-minute Let's Play, that's 20 minutes of viewer engagement. And he talks about how YouTube is really trying to become like Netflix, basically, the kind of thing that you turn on and watch for long periods of times and wants to essentially replace television, which means it needs to reward more engaging, longer form content, which it's doing. But he says what has changed is the and he gives a word for it, but basically the ability to post a video one day and the next day new video comes out and people immediately come back. And he says that that's very difficult for even daily vloggers because creating that kind of content is taxing, as all three of us, I'm sure, are very aware. But he says that's part of the reason that you're seeing more and more news items and, you know, Jimmy Fallon every night or whatever, because these are entities that are already used to a daily grind of creating, half hour to an hour of brand new content every single day, day in, day out. And they've got that kind of content that's able to pop up and immediately day after day, people will go and watch, you know, the latest Jimmy Fallon sketch or whatever.
I was thinking about this because I was obviously the whole PewDiePie thing kind of blew up over the last few days. But would you say that the algorithm turn that they seem to be complaining about that happened around the same time that your channel started to see growth, that maybe you are doing the kind of content that YouTube wants a reward?
Partly,
yeah, Brian.
But, well, if so, that it's by design. I mean, I've talked about it before. The TubeFilter did a really good breakdown of kind of best practices, and whereas the theory had been like, you know, make a 3-second video of a cat farting, and then you'll get all the hits and all the money.
Great video, Brian.
Yeah, I know. But you know, they moved to total watch time, which is why Modern Rogue is a little bit longer, but that means we have to work harder to keep it engaging, you know, for an entire 10 to 15 minutes instead of, you know, the 5 minutes that most scam schools can get away
with. Coming up, what part of my anatomy do I put into Ryan's mouth? Stay tuned.
Yeah, who knows? Well, and there are people that use the curiosity, you know, gap as a cheap way to make that work. But anyway, it's a fantastic article, short video that I think is very fair and even-handed.
Yeah. It's interesting to look at, like, Facebook went through with their whole, like, yeah, we were counting video views differently, and yeah, we know that it really worked out to our advantage, and we're going to fix this. And you're like, you're a $400 billion company. You're telling me that not a single person at Facebook did the numbers and knew that the way you're doing video counts was advantageous to you and misrepresented what you're providing advertisers. Nobody in your entire company said, hey, we need to fix this. A little suspicious.
Pump and circ. It's just, you know, same. All this has happened before and it'll happen again. Whenever you're trying to sell advertising on top of content, there's always going to be content makers lying about how many people watch them.
Yeah, it's Facebook, though. I'm saying that's the thing.
It's dirty. It's dirty. Like,
they have so much power. I think that's why people are afraid to say how dirty that was.
Yeah.
Was the specific transgression?
So the way you were getting these reports of, like, how your video views were working, like if you put a video up there, whatever, is Facebook was counting, like, you know, like, I think I forgot, like, the way that it worked.
I heard it was like 4 seconds without audio. If you lingered on it for more than 4 seconds, even before the audio or without audio, they called that a view. Is that right?
Yeah, they're like, so it was like they're off by like 20% of like the full views versus this whatever. So there was like a 20% difference or something, the way the algorithm kind of thing worked, which but it worked to their advantage. And it's if that did not work to their advantage, how quickly do you think that would have been fixed?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, so listen, I don't know. I'm just saying when you're a $400 billion company, when you're that huge and you have this thing going on for a year, and there was like something else too about that. And it's like, you know, not shocked, but it's kind of the lack of outrage surprised me. But then it's like, it's kind of like the people who have the most to complain are kind of, you know that I've benefited and not benefited from the mysterious algorithm there. So.
Yeah, but I'll tell you, man, it is kind of a scary thing, you know, seeing, you know, you work so hard to get to a channel that reaches so many people, but then you see that, you know, I understand these folks' terror, where it's like they used to be able to reach all these people who are subscribers, and now just not so much.
Mm-hmm. So my pick is going to be, I think, for the interest of pop culture and understanding things, there's a little indie movie coming out, I think, sometime this week. I want you to guys check it out so we can talk about it next week. I'll let you figure out what it is.
Okay. Well, it's really just fan fiction, right? It takes place in an established universe.
Mm-hmm. Man, those tweets coming out of the premiere, though. Holy smokes, right?
I haven't seen Andrew was kind of shocked when he asked me about the reaction. I was like, I haven't noticed any. I haven't looked.
Yeah. I wish I could live in your bubble.
No, it's pretty high praise so far. So hopefully everything turns out next week when it comes out.
I mean, we just want a good movie. Up inside, we're like, please be awesome, please be awesome, please. I just want a good movie. Please be awesome, please be awesome. Please change my life and give me value.
Hey, did you, Justin or Andrew, see the Verge article singing the praises of Movies with Mikey?
I did. Yeah. Yeah. No, it was very, very, very well done. I think it got to the essence of why I like that series so much.
Yeah.
I mean, aside from the fact that, like, Mikey's a friend, and, you know, obviously we're going to shill for our friends, but, it's great. I highly recommend everybody check it out. So, my pick is last night I was at a wedding and, somebody mentioned something during the rehearsal dinner, and I wanted to see how easy it was. And that was setting up a Snapchat geo filter. So if you are familiar with the Snapchat platform, if you take a picture or video, if you swipe to the left or to the right, there are these little overlays. So a lot of them are geographically generated. So you get like the city that you're in, that kind of stuff. You can set up your own. And it was really cheap and really easy to do, to have the filter going for 12 hours. I think it was 13 hours, actually. It was only $15, and I wound up paying for artwork, and I didn't need to. You know, they have their own little art, you know, no Photoshop needed, you know, filter generator that you can run right through their site. I thought it was super, you know, a super easy process for sure. You you draw out exactly how much space you want on their map, and then based on how big your area is how they wind up charging you. But I was shocked at how easy it was, and you know, it made me king of the millennials at the wedding last night, so I was very excited.
Here's the thing that I like to play now, and I'm going to pull up this example. Do you all know who Emma Morano is?
Mm-mm. I do not.
Emma Morano is the oldest living person. She's 117 years old.
Wow.
She was born in 1899. So Emma Morano, when Emma Morano was, you know, 17, 18, it was 1916. The average age of a lot of people listening right now when she was that age was 100 years ago. Okay. Wow. I want you to explain to teenage Emma Morano, when we talk about like, hey, like what happens when the robots take our jobs? We talk about new jobs. Tell teenage Emma Morano what the hell that thing is you just paid money for.
Yeah, no, I mean, listen, it was hard to explain it to people my age. So I do not envy explaining it to her.
Forgive me, I drifted ever so slightly while you were doing that. I had something pop up, but then I read the thing and I still don't understand the tangible benefit to it. Is that you reach more people or...
Basically,
explain
you can just create
to a 2016 Brian Brushman.
I mean, I already have difficulty. I'm getting better about understanding Snapchat. It was a
filter for the wedding so that people could take snaps and it would have the images on it already.
Got it.
So let's say.
So Justin foots the bill and everybody at that venue gets this thing to tag their stuff automatically.
Yes.
Got it. Okay.
So let's say me and you are doing a live Night Attack show.
Right.
Right. We pay for that. And now everybody who's there taking pictures and videos on Snapchat and sharing it, now we look like that much bigger of a deal because we have a filter.
Got it.
So like that business model, we've got inside the Snapchat system, you're paying for a service when you take a photo inside this geolocation on using your mobile device with a camera system connected to the internet. You know, connect all of these things that are just so. When we're talking about what jobs do we do when the robots take over, that's going to be an economy even more complex than the one right now, where there is a service that does this, and you could have. You might come up with Snapchat could have a third party service that could say, hey, we'll design specialty filters or things like this, kind of like wedding photography, whatever. We'll create a special design so everybody takes photos, it gets aggregated. You could create like very crazy business models, not to say that that's what it will be, but you can imagine like that. Now, one of the things I was thinking about, like if I said, oh, how about a tourist guide for like virtual worlds? You know, somebody like, you know, if I'm in virtual world, a tourist guide, you're like, oh, okay, maybe. Yeah, it's called Twitch.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That's right. That's right. Where it's like, I want you to take me on a tour. Like, I don't want to actually have to get good at Overwatch. Just show me all the coolest things to do in Overwatch. Oh, that is really clever.
So that's kind of like, I was thinking about writing that book about like the future. I might use an example like, virtual, you know, tour. You know, tourist guide. Like, well, that sounds weird. And then you're like, no, it's called Twitch. You're like, oh, that's real. Like, yeah. And like, then what's the lineage to that? Back in the 1980s was like people publishing those little booklets, like, you know, how to win on Atari games, you know, back even further, how to win at poker, you know, how to do these things.
I bought a full paperback book. I think it was 130 pages long. It was nothing but page by page describing what moves to make on each frame of Dragon's Lair. It's like you're going to walk in. There's a potion that says drink me. You're going to go left towards it. Then the floor is going to collapse. You're going to do back, and then you're going to hit sword to hit the spider. Now you're on to the next one.
Dude, that buying that guide was smart because that saved you a lot of money because that game was effing hard.
Yeah,
that game was impossible. Oh, my God.
It's crazy. It was so cool. I kept putting quarters in. You know, I was like, yep, Don Bluth Studios, you did it. Gentlemen, did it. You good?
Son of a bitch. Oh, man, we're the best.
Yeah. You realize the next time we do an After Things, we're all going to be touched. We're all going to be different men.
Assuming I can buy a ticket. I haven't bought a ticket.
Brian. Justin, you realize the next time you and I do this show.
Thursday night, baby. Thursday night.
How awesome
at the
would
Alamo
it be
Draft House in SF.
Just it. We just got to gloat, you know, and just. That would not be cool at all.
I'll read the novelization and pretend like I saw the movie. Oh, yeah. You remember that one part where you're like, that wasn't in the movie. I was like, I'm sure it was in their inner dialogue. I'm sure they were remembering a time that happened.
Yeah. I remember when Jyn Erso was thinking this reminded her of. Yeah. I'm psychic in movies. I can read their minds now. Like, oh, wow.
Yeah.
Ghost dog in Star Wars. All right, gentlemen.
Yep.
Been after.
The Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.